Abraham Lincoln, Chapter 5, Life as a Lawyer on the Circuit. At the close of Lincoln's term in Congress in 1849, he determined to retire from politics and take up again the practice of law. This was for two reasons. The first was that the position he had taken in regard to the Mexican War had made him so unpopular that he knew he could not carry the next election from his state, even if he should wish to do so. His term in Congress had added nothing to the political favor in which he was held. Again, overtaken by depression, he even questioned his fitness for political life, and it seemed to him more than likely that he would never go into politics again. The second reason was that his financial outlook was by no means promising. The debt from his storekeeping experience at New Salem still hung heavy about his neck, and his own growing family, although he lived very simply, was becoming more expensive. In addition to these burdens, his father's family still looked to him for some of the necessaries and about all of the comforts of life. Whether he had to furnish money to prevent the foreclosure of a mortgage on his father's farm, or to pay doctor's bills, or to meet other expense, his father's family was always more or less of a drain upon his purse. We must bear in mind also that Lincoln was not by nature a moneymaker. His income from his law practice was never large, not more than $3,000 a year. It might easily have been more, but his fees were small, and oftentimes he charged nothing for his services, especially when he thought the client too poor to pay. Naturally, his brother lawyers objected to this generous habit, on the ground that Lincoln thus lowered the standard of charges for legal services. But his love of fair play was stronger than his sense of money values. His plainly furnished law office was in keeping with his character. It contained a chair, a lounge, and a desk. Not that he needed the desk to write upon, for more frequently it served as a footrest while he supported on his knees the book on which he wrote. Surroundings did not affect him. He could withdraw his mind from any confusion about him, and had no difficulty in marshaling the facts of his well-ordered knowledge just when he wanted to use them. He kept his notes and memoranda on slips of paper, which he stowed away in his hat, a habit formed in the earlier days when he was postmaster at New Salem. Although Lincoln's office was in Springfield, his business took him over a wide stretch of country, for in those days it was not possible in the West for lawyers to make a good living in any one place. Their practice extended over what was known as a circuit, that is, one of several divisions in a state set apart under an appointed judge, who traveled from county seat to county seat. The judge made the circuit twice a year, and with him traveled some of the best-known lawyers of the district. Lincoln's circuit was the 8th Judicial Circuit. It was 150 miles long, 150 miles broad, and contained from 12 to 15 counties. This kind of law practice strongly appealed to Lincoln, for he liked traveling from county to county in company with the circuit judge and the other lawyers to attend courts when they were in session. Alert-minded and always open to new impressions, he felt an interest in the people he met and in everything he saw on the highways, in the fields and on the farms. And while sometimes he would sit silent and absorbed with a sad, brooding expression, most of the time he was the life and joy of the company, seeing humor and entertainment in all the small, homely incidents on the way. It might be men working in the fields, ducks waddling to a pond, a washing flapping in the wind, almost anything that would catch his fancy and keep the crowd in a continuous, rollicking mood to their journey's end. An incident of this period, told by a brother lawyer, reveals his care and tenderness for helpless creatures. He had been riding one day with a group of fellow lawyers when he was missed by his companions. One of them, going back to look for him, found that he had stopped to replace two young birds that had been blown out of their nest. "I couldn't have slept," he said, "if I had not restored them to their mother." As there were no railroads in Illinois until 1850, travel was generally on horseback, but sometimes several lawyers would join in getting a three-seated spring wagon. At first, Lincoln rode on a borrowed horse, but later he bought one for himself, which he called Old Tom. After his return from Washington, he added to his turnout an old open buggy. The pokey horse, the rattletrap buggy, and Lincoln made one of the most interesting pictures of the days of circuit riding. His dress was often wrinkled and rusty. Sometimes he wore a low-crowned hat and sometimes a shaggy beaver. For a long time, his coat was a short blue one, which reached only to his hips. He usually carried a little old handbag and a faded, weather-beaten umbrella tied with a string to keep it from flapping. Of course, Lincoln did not appear so peculiar amid the pioneer conditions surrounding him as he would have done in a part of the country which had long been settled. The dress of the people living in such a backwoods region as Illinois at that time was distinctly different from what could be found in a long-settled state, Massachusetts, for instance, or Virginia. But it must be said that, at best, Lincoln was always indifferent to dress and careless about clothes. There were few roads such as we know today, and no bridges at all. The streams had to be forded, and as Lincoln was tall, he sometimes rolled up his trousers and tested the depth of the water by wading across to the other side. Then the others would follow. Whenever in their journeyings they stopped for dinner at a farmhouse, Lincoln again was the life of the company. Everybody along the circuit liked him because of his kindness and good cheer. The comfort of traveling in those days was far removed from what it is today, and Lincoln's good nature and drollery must have been very helpful in relieving unpleasant situations from his brother lawyers, who did not hesitate to grumble at what they considered hardships. The taverns at the county seats were usually two-story houses with large rooms and long verandas. The judge and the lawyer slept two in a bed, with three or four beds in a room. There was a common table where judge, jury, lawyers, prisoners, peddlers, and all ate together, the upper end of the table being reserved for the judge and his lawyers. But Lincoln was as likely to sit at one end as the other. At the tavern, he met with a hearty welcome from all, for he was the best known and the best loved lawyer on the circuit. At every county seat were a few houses of pretension where formal entertainments were given during the court session. At these functions, Lincoln was always an appreciated guest. But the place most to his liking was the courthouse. This was generally a small square building of red brick, trimmed with white and surmounted by a cupola. In the one room it contained, the judge held his court. The lawyers pleaded their cases, and the jury listened and deliberated. The cases were mostly simple ones concerning boundaries, deeds, trespasses, etc. The lawyers and their clients consulted in little groups apart, under the trees, or at the side of the building, or wherever they could find a quiet corner. Lincoln's advice was always to settle, if possible, without a trial. Lawyers, he thought, should work for peace, even though there would be plenty of cases for all. So we may imagine him laboring first with his client before he turns the force of his clear, plain arguments upon the listening judge and jury. Here is what he says to a young man who complains about his guardian. "I know Mr. Kingsbury, and he is not the man to have cheated you out of a cent, and I can't take the case, and I advise you to drop it." Lincoln was an especial favorite with Judge David Davis, a man of force and much learning, who for many years presided over the courts in the Eighth Circuit while Lincoln practiced there. Unless he was present in the company which gathered in the judge's room after supper, his honor seemed to be dissatisfied. He would constantly interrupt the conversation with such impatient questions as, "Where's Lincoln? Why doesn't Lincoln come?" And when the genial, good-natured Lincoln did appear and begin to tell the stories which delighted all the listeners, the judge rebuked any man who dared to interrupt with the stern remark, "Mr. Lincoln is talking." Although while out of court the judge was somewhat indifferent to formality, he was very insistent when in the courtroom upon good order and serious attention to the work in hand. When Lincoln was not busy, he was often whispering stories to his neighbors. This sometimes annoyed Judge Davis, who would then call him to order. "I was never fined but once for contempt of court," said a clerk at one of the county seats in Lincoln's day. "Judge Davis fined me $5. Mr. Lincoln had just come in, and leaning over my desk, he told me a story so irresistibly funny that I broke out into a loud laugh. The judge called me and ordered in haste, saying, 'This must be stopped. Mr. Lincoln, you are constantly disturbing this court with your stories.' Then to me, 'You may fine yourself $5 for your disturbance.' I apologized, but told the judge that the story was worth the money. In a few minutes, the judge called me to him. 'What was the story Lincoln told you?' he asked. I told him, and he laughed aloud in spite of himself. 'Remit your fine,' he ordered." As a lawyer, Lincoln had great power over a jury, but this was not through any attempt at oratory. His method was to get at the heart of the matter, to present it plainly and simply so that it could be clearly understood. He had a good knowledge of law, but it was his instinct for right and justice that enabled him to strip away unnecessary detail and present his case in a practical way to the jury. For this purpose, he made free use of stories, not to amuse his juries, as some have supposed, but to make them see the case clearly and to avoid long arguments. One of the lawyers who knew him said, "In making a speech, Mr. Lincoln was the plainest man I ever heard. He was not a speaker, but a talker. He talked to jurors and to political gatherings, plain, sensible, candid talk, almost as in conversation, making no effort whatever at oratory. But his talk had wonderful effect. Honesty, candor, fairness, everything that was convincing was in his manner and expression." Lincoln could not take the side which he believed was wrong. In order to convince others, he must himself believe that his case was right and just. It was simply impossible for him to argue against his convictions. To do so, he believed, would be dishonest, and he could no more be dishonest in this way than he could steal. It happened once that, during the course of a case he was trying, he became sure of his client's guilt. Suddenly he turned to his associate and whispered, "Swift, the man is guilty. You defend him. I cannot." And immediately he gave up his share of the fee, which was large enough to mean a great deal to him. At another time, while he was defending a man on trial, he turned to his associate with the remark, "If you can say anything for the man, do it. I cannot. If I attempt it, the jury will see I think he is guilty and convict him." He then gave up the case. The informal ways of the court and the familiar footing of Lincoln with his juries is well illustrated by the Armstrong case. In the course of his law practice, he was sent for by Jack Armstrong's widow, who asked him to defend her son, who was charged with murder. You will remember the Jack Armstrong with whom he had the wrestling match at New Salem, and who had become a lifelong friend. When Jack Armstrong's widow asked him to take the case, he cheerfully complied, insisting that he would charge nothing for his services. The principal witness against young Armstrong declared that he saw the prisoner strike the blow which caused the death of the murdered man. Lincoln asked, "When did you see the blow struck?" The witness answered, "It was about 10 o'clock at night." "How could you see plainly at that hour?" asked Lincoln. "Why," was the answer, "the moon was full and was shining so brightly that it was as high as the sun is about 10 o'clock in the morning." Lincoln then turned to an almanac and showed that at 10 o'clock on the night named, the moon was in its last quarter and was almost setting. This unexpected turn in the case, of course, set at naught the value of the witness's testimony and produced a great effect upon the feeling of the jury and the people in the courtroom. In addressing the jury, Lincoln said that it was a pleasure to him to give his services to help clear from a false charge the son of his old friend. He then told of the days when, homeless and almost friendless, he used to go to the log cabin of the Armstrongs, where he found food and shelter, and where his worn clothing was mended by the kindly mother of the prisoner. Lincoln made such a pathetic appeal that the tears rolled down the cheeks of the jurors, some of whom had known him in those days. And every man, when the jury filed back into the courtroom, returned a verdict of not guilty. Lincoln's law cases were not limited to those in the circuit courts. He argued many, and some were very important ones, in the Supreme Court of Illinois, showing that he was one of the leading lawyers of the state. In one of these cases, Lincoln was counsel for the Illinois Central Railroad, a railroad of which George B. McClellan later became vice president. His high standing was recognized by his being engaged as associate counsel in a famous patent case in 1855 in Cincinnati. His client, the manufacturer of the McCormick Reaper, had $400,000 at stake. When, however, he found that the opposing counsel was an eminent lawyer from the East, he lost confidence in Lincoln, the country lawyer whom he had engaged on another's recommendation, and called in Edwin M. Stanton of Ohio to assist. Stanton paid little attention to the awkward, raw-boned man from the backwoods, as he appeared to him, and evidently looked upon Lincoln as an inferior. He was heard to say in a scornful tone, "Where did that long-armed creature come from, and what can he expect from this case?" So, almost ignoring Lincoln, Stanton took upon himself the burden of making the speech to the jury, and thus, without Lincoln's assistance, won the case. This was a keen disappointment to Lincoln and his friends, for they had hoped that he would have an opportunity to win distinction. But there came a time, as we shall learn later, when this same Edwin M. Stanton learned to respect and admire the true Lincoln and to follow his leadership. Lincoln's term in Congress, although it interrupted his law practice, proved a great benefit, for it inspired him with a renewed zest to increase his knowledge. His experiences in Washington had given the opportunity to study the leaders in Congress, and he keenly realized that the training of these men was very much better than his own. In their public speaking, they had shown a power of close and sustained reasoning which he could not command but was ambitious to acquire. So when he gave up political life and returned to the practice of law, he had resolved to apply himself to make good, if possible, the deficiency of his early training, and thus be able to meet these well-trained lawyers on equal terms. Books and study once more became a passion with him. Mathematics, astronomy, and poetry were the subjects he now took up. He even joined a class of young men who were learning German, inviting them to meet in his office. With the same care and thoroughness that he had devoted to English grammar years before, he now studied geometry, learning 6 books of Euclid by heart. This close application to books made it impossible to spend so much time with his brother lawyers as he formerly had done. Now, after he had told a story, he would often slip away while the listeners were laughing at the climax. At night, when riding the circuit, it became his habit to read, sometimes until 2 o'clock in the morning, by the light of a candle standing on a chair near the head of his bed. But notwithstanding the late hour when he went to sleep, he was usually up before any of the others, and when they opened their eyes they could see him sitting before the fire with the coals uncovered, musing and pondering. A very agreeable and charming side of Lincoln's personality is seen in his home life during this period. While careless of conventions, he was by no means negligent of the virtues for which they stood. As a homemaker, he bore his part in the responsibilities of the family life, and was especially delightful as a host. It was a pleasure among the Lincolns' friends to be bidden to their home, for Mrs. Lincoln was an efficient hostess, always providing an abundant table with delicious Southern cooking, and was tactful in putting her guests at ease, while Mr. Lincoln, with his cordial welcome, afforded rich entertainment by his store of anecdotes and his unrivaled conversation. As a father, he was most affectionate and lenient. His 3 boys, Robert, born in 1843, Willie in 1849, and Tad, or Thomas, in 1853, regarded their father as their best playfellow. He rarely went downtown from his home in Springfield without the 2 younger boys, carrying one perhaps on his back, while the other clung to his hand. On one occasion, a neighbor was called to his door by the cries of 2 boys. Looking out, he saw Mr. Lincoln striding by with a boy on either side of him, each one crying at the top of his voice. "Why, Mr. Lincoln, what's the matter with the boys?" my neighbor asked. "Just what's the matter with the whole world," he answered. "I've got 3 walnuts, and each wants 2. His sense of humor was always keen and stood out in striking contrast with the melancholy which often dominated his thoughts and feelings for hours or even days at a time. Thus we see that up to 1854, Lincoln lived a simple, natural, industrious life, not unlike that of many another ambitious young man born in a log cabin on the western frontier. Yet in the light of later events, it is clear that unconsciously he was preparing for the large responsibilities awaiting him, and that always under the surface of his life, an eternal purpose seemed to be working its way. The qualities of heart which were his in so generous measure, honesty, charity, and sympathy for the suffering, were the qualities peculiarly needed for the great mission to which he was called. Through his experience as a lawyer, also, he was gaining a knowledge of men and was developing the habits of clear thinking and just reasoning, which were soon to be applied to a great issue involving the nation. That issue we are now to take up.